I'm really going to spend the next 30, 40 minutes answering a question. And this is the question. Does Benedict's 2009 encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, mark a shift away from an earlier interest in the natural law? That's it. Does Benedict shift in 2009 away from an earlier interest in the natural law? Vincent Strand thinks so. He concludes that because the practical conclusions reached by Benedict in Caritas in Veritate rest on an explicitly theological foundation rather than a philosophical foundation of the natural law, Caritas in Veritate marks a new turn in Catholic social thought, away from Benedict's earlier interest in Thomism. Strand contrasts the Benedict in Caritas in Veritate, who is all about the gift or grace, with what he calls the neoconservative position that draws on a type of Thomism that separates the natural and the supernatural spheres, and concludes that Benedict's rejection of this separation of nature and grace in favor of everything as gift explains why he proceeds from the natural law in Caritas in Veritate. I find several problems with Strand's argument. In the first place, his characterization of a Thomism that draws a sharp line between nature and grace sounds to me like little more than a familiar stereotype in these kinds of theological debates. We've all heard it. I'm not sure it's adequate. In fact, I think my colleague here, Father Fields, has the better theological argument in the same volume of Nova et Vetera that Strand published his article in, when Father Fields notes that Benedict, quote, understands grace and nature as dialectically analogous in his 2005 encyclical Deus Caritas Est. Now, did Benedict drop his analogical understanding of the relationship of nature and grace in the 4 years between Deus Caritas Est and Veritate, Caritas in Veritate, and thus in those 4 years prescind from an earlier commitment to a Thomistic view of the natural law? One problem with that assumption is that even Strand recognizes, albeit in a footnote, that Benedict explicitly refers to the natural law in several places in Caritas in Veritate, although Strand points out that these references to the natural law are not significantly developed. And that's a fair point. In fact, Benedict never fully develops a theory of the natural law. And I don't think that's too surprising, because he's a theologian, he's not a jurist. But that doesn't mean he doesn't rely on certain assumptions about what the natural law is when he brings up the natural law in his writings. And what I hope to do in the few minutes following is to clarify what his guiding assumptions about the natural law are. First, let's start with recognizing another problem with Strand's argument, that European scholars, Germans in particular, who have looked carefully at Benedict's legal philosophy, have come to precisely the opposite conclusion from Strand about Benedict's interest in the natural law. Martin Romheimer argues that Benedict offers a fulsome defense of the natural law in his 2011 address to the German Bundestag, 2 years after his supposed rejection of the natural law in Caritas in Veritate. And Manfred Spieker argues that Benedict moves away from an earlier rejection of the natural law in a 1964 article, the only one of Benedict's publications that has the natural law's title, one I'll talk about in a minute. He moves away from that to an embrace of the natural law, a move that Spieker has traced to sometime around the year 2000 in the context of the certificate controversy that arose over the liberalization of abortion in Germany. Spieker reads the same encyclical as Strand, Caritas in Veritate, as part of a whole with Deus Caritas Est, the Regensburg Address of 2006, and the Bundestag Address. And this whole is a robust defense of basic human rights on the basis of the natural law. Now, how shall we account for such divergent interpretations of Benedict's texts and his view of the natural law? To be fair to Strand, the English translation of Spieker's article did not come out until this year, and that makes it a year after Strand's argument appeared in Nova et Vetera. And while Ronheimer's English article appeared in 2015, it was included in an anthology of legal scholars, making it easy for a theologian like Strand to miss. First of all, then, we must recognize a difference in the field of Benedict's studies between Anglophone scholarship and Germanic scholarship. In the Anglophone field, there has been scant attention to the natural law in Benedict's thought. Strand's 2017 article is an important exception. But that article is not really about the natural law, Strand's article. It's really more about the broader theological problem of nature and grace in Benedict's thought, and the natural law is only brought in as a subset of that theological problem. As offshoots of Strand's theological analysis of the problem of nature and grace, his conclusions about Benedict's understanding of the natural law are highly susceptible to error. In addition, limitations of language are always important factors in scholarship. We should not forget this. Benedict's one article that addresses the natural law by name remains untranslated from the German. I have it with me if anybody wants to read it. And rarely, if ever, cited in the Anglophone scholarship. It has been introduced briefly to the Anglophone public only this year in David Lutz's translation of Speaker's article. Also, only this year, we finally have many of Benedict's writings on political and legal themes available in a convenient English language volume, Faith and Politics, published by Ignatius Press. Now, in addition to language, history matters. Catholics working in traditions shaped by British, Australian, Canadian, and American experiences, among those of other Anglophone countries, share a different history in terms of the relationship of political institutions to the Church than Germans like Benedict do. As Speaker notes, German Catholicism was distinguished by its sensibility for institutions that ensure freedom and legal systems, as well as for the separation of church and state. Speaker's point should not be restricted to theological or cultural implications, although those are also important. To understand Benedict's view of the natural law, we need to consider German jurisprudence, how the law has been understood by leading German jurists, particularly Catholic German jurists, in the years leading up to Benedict's intellectual formation. So allow me a brief, very brief, digression down the road of German jurisprudence in order to set the context for a better understanding of Benedict's view of the natural law. But I want to note, this digression is not led by a German, but by a Japanese jurist, Paul Francis Kotaro Tanaka, one of the 20th century's leading jurists and one trained in German jurisprudence. I hope that by allowing a Japanese jurist to lead us into German jurisprudence, I've made a relevant point about the universality of law, even while recognizing the importance of the relativity of knowledge to culture and language. But this Japanese in particular is important because Tanaka and Benedict have so close an understanding of the natural law that Tanaka provides an important window through which to see more clearly the background and details of Benedict's understanding of the natural law. In his work on the natural law, Tanaka emphasizes the importance of a German legal movement called Freirecht, which should not be understood, as the cognate would suggest, as free law, but as the sociological science of law. This early 20th century legal movement sought to turn the tables on legal positivism by locating the source of law in social relationships rather than in the sovereignty of the state. In short, free law meant to free law from the state. You might even say from positivism. For those drawn to the German sociological science of law, like Eugen Ehrlich, the primacy of society meant that each state could be home to any number of different societies, each with its own internally binding regulations and mores. This sociological school of law was the precondition for the early 20th century renaissance of the natural law in Germany, and many of the leaders of this school were Catholics, Ehrlich himself, but also François Genie and Joseph Kohler. Now, Genie, of course, was French, but he was in close contact with the German sociological school. And Genie reinforced the connection that the sociological school had to the natural law when he wrote, "If natural law is called upon to circumscribe the activities of man, it must never forget that man presents himself less as an individual than as a member of society, which puts him in continuous contact and relations with his fellows." Not all aspects or members of the sociological school accepted the natural law. Gustav Radbruch did not come around to accepting the natural law until late in life, after he had witnessed the horrors of the Third Reich. But this school of legal studies played an important role in the rise of an interest in the natural law in the early 20th century by freeing the concept of law from dependency on the state. and it led in Germany to an interest in the natural law that emphasized its grounding in social relations in contrast to the abstract individualistic natural law of the Enlightenment period. To bring this back to Benedict, we can turn to Speaker, who notes that, quote, when nature is discussed in the text of Benedict XVI, it does not mean primarily the nature that surrounds human persons. The term always has instead an anthropological connotation. It is about the human person. It is at the heart of the entire social order, and according to Benedict XVI, in agreement with Thomas Aquinas, signifies what is most perfect in nature. Romheimer agrees. He points out that for Benedict, human nature is not simply nature, certainly not the nature of the environmental movement, and the natural law is not simply a law that nature reveals to us in some unambiguous way. Instead, it is always and only an ordering of reason, rationis ordinatio, as Thomas Aquinas formulated it in agreement with canonical and early scholastic tradition. Of course, the human person never exists in isolation as a radically individualistic being. To be human is to exist with and for others, or to be in society. This is what Jacques Maritain meant when he called the human person an open whole, un tout ouvert. This highlighting of the social movement in the natural law is worth keeping in mind when we encounter Benedict referring to the social natural law. To refer to the social element in the natural law is merely to say that the reason that lies at the heart of the individual person also has a social aspect. Beginning in the Protestant Reformation and intensifying during the Enlightenment, reason became subjectified, seen as the exclusive property of an individual who was increasingly defined against the social whole. This was a radical departure from the classical understanding, going back to Aristotle, that man is by nature a social animal, an understanding that had been accepted and developed by the Catholic Church. Just as reason was seen to order the individual person's acts in accordance with what is right, so too did it function to order the individual's relations with others, society, and thus to order society itself. This may not be the appropriate place to fully develop this argument on the right relationship of reason, society, and the natural law, but it's important at least to grasp the main point. The relationship of the individual and society is not one of mutual exclusion. Reason assists in the ordering of the individual's moral behavior and at the same time ordering society for the good. The natural law reflects man's nature as a social animal, and so the natural law stems from both the individual as a moral actor and from society in which the individual always exists. This is a complex question. So perhaps a closer look at Benedict's Caritas in Veritate will help clarify his sociological understanding of the natural law. To my knowledge, all the commentators on this encyclical, whether they see it as embracing the natural law or not, have ignored one critical phrase in the text. In section 6, Benedict cites the classic legal maxim, ubi societas ibi jus, which unfortunately has the English translation glossed as, every society draws up its own system of justice. Now, this English translation makes it sound as if justice changes its meaning from one society to another. That would be to assert moral relativism, something which we all know Benedict was strongly against. So what does Benedict mean here by ubi societas ibi jus? The English translation not only makes a relativist claim, every society does its own thing with justice, but it removes the issue of law and replaces it with a broader philosophical question of justice. We need to interrogate this phrase more deeply because that phrase, I submit, holds the key to Benedict's understanding of the natural law. In German, Benedict's native language, the critical term in the encyclical is rendered as system of justice, Reichssystem, legal system, which is contrasted later in the paragraph with the term Gerechtigkeit, justice. In Latin, the term is justitia, which is translated nicely as justice. But justitia is not the same as jus, which is better translated as law. I think the problem of translation here stems from the German language, where the term Recht straddles the English distinction between law and justice. And it's not just German that does this. In 1932, my Japanese friend Tanaka, friend loosely, he died pretty much when I was a kid, never met him. In 1932, Tanaka highlighted this problem of terminology in his sociological study of world law that criticized the positivism of John Austin and others who had reduced law to the command of the sovereign. Of course, for a positivist, law and justice are one and the same thing, and the purpose of both was social control. To Tanaka, law was more about than control of the people, although he certainly would not deny that that's one aspect of the law. For him, fundamentally, law was about justice. Any law that was not just was, in serious ways, an imperfect law at best. Like Benedict, Tanaka defined the essence of law as an effort to achieve the common good, bonum commune, of society, which means to achieve justice. Tanaka, who was quite a polyglot, pointed out that this link between law and justice, or the right, is found in the terms for law in many languages other than English. Jus, Recht, Droit, Derito, Derecho, Pravo in Russian. The important point is that if we understand jus and Recht and Benedict's citation of the maxim ubi societas ibi jus as law rather than justice, the moral relativism immediately dissipates. To say that every society has its own justice implies a moral relativistic rejection of one universally applicable concept of justice. But it is hardly a relativistic claim simply to note that every society has its own legal system. In fact, the natural law presumes as much. Not only that different societies today have different legal systems from each other, but that even a single society will establish different legal systems over time, all as efforts to more accurately codify the natural law through accrued experience and understanding. To grasp, then, how this phrase, ubi societas ibi jus, reveals Benedict's understanding of the natural law, we need to look at it more carefully. The phrase has a curious history, or perhaps I should say no history, often mistakenly attributed to Cicero, Ulpian, Hugo Grotius, Baron Heinrich von Kolkeche. There appears to be no classical source for the exact phrase. It may well have been coddled together from the following syllogism in Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, where Aristotle writes, ubi homo, ibi societas. Ubi societas, ibi jus. Ergo, ubi homo, ibi jus. So we can put it together. The legal scholar Alessandro Levi, who titled an essay of his own, ubi societas, ibi jus, wrote that the origin history of the phrase are, as far as I know, still unknown. The origin of the phrase was also unknown to Tanaka, even though the maxim ubi societas ibi jus was the leitmotif of his lifelong study of the natural law. His translation of the phrase, which I think is right, is wherever there is society, there is law. His point, following Aristotle's syllogism, was that wherever humans exist, there is law because law does not presume a state or a king. Law is inherent to human life. And in that sense, its origins should be sought in society. Law is simply the mechanism by which men, all men, regulate the inevitable conflicts that arise among them. These conflicts are not always with the political state, as corporate law shows. They arise in private life, too. The maxim was also a refutation of Protestant jurists like Rudolf Sohm, who famously argued that ecclesiastical law contradicts the very nature of the ecclesia. Sohm believed that the bureaucratization of the Catholic Church, replete with something called canon law, was a later development that had betrayed the Church's origins in charisma. To him, law was a matter for the state and not for the Church. Thus, it is no surprise to find that his Catholic contemporary, Eugen Ehrlich, embraced the maxim, ubi societas ibi jus, to explain and justify his insistence on the multiplicity of legal orders under any given state framework. One of those social orders, albeit not entirely under a given state, is the church. Tanaka, as a specialist in corporate law, use the maximum that wherever there is a society, there is law, to point out how in every society by its nature, how every society by its nature has laws that regulate its members. Trade groups, scholarly associations, corporations are all forms of society with their own laws. So too is the church, a society with its own laws to regulate human behavior within it. I wrote this before I was thinking about the kinds of questions I might get today about how well that law's regulated behavior in the church. Let's maybe put that off for the Q&A. Of course, the recognition that law has its origins in society was a major contribution of the sociological school, the Freirecht. And it was a direct refutation of the positivists who had rejected the natural law in favor of a theory of law as the commands of the sovereign of the state. But Tanaka went further than most members of the sociological school of law. By recognizing the Catholic Church as a society, he pointed out that if there are societies or associations that subsist within the state, there are also societies that transcend the state. The existence of the Catholic Church as a visible, global society with canon law applicable to people across the globe pointed to the existence of law as something universal, something not restricted to constitutions and positive laws of individual nation states. Society in this global sense indicated something akin to the nature in natural law. It was found wherever human beings were found. So following Tanaka, we can see that the nature in natural law does not refer chiefly to nature as the created material world or the physical environment. Nature refers to the person and his ends, along with his inherent rational ability to identify his ends and regulate his behavior to achieve those ends. This is not well understood by the positivists, who, following David Hume and neo-Kantians like Hans Kelsen, argue that natural law theory is based on what they call the naturalist fallacy, or the idea that an ought, Zolan, can be derived from an is, Sein. What they don't understand is that for Benedict and for Tanaka, nature refers to the person. As a moral agent, the person is a being, a Sein, who always by his very rational nature includes within him the question of what he ought to do, the Zolan. The Zolan is in the Sein. This is not to reduce the natural law to ethics, but is in fact to recognize that the natural law rests on the metaphysical foundation of the person as a rational moral agent. But here we must be careful not to interpret the metaphysical foundation of the natural law as meaning that it's transcendent of human reason, or that the natural law is equivalent to the revealed divine law, the lex aeterna. We should never forget the natural law, lex naturalis, lies between positive law, lex humana, and the revealed law, lex aeterna or lex divina. This nuance was largely lost during the Enlightenment period in the works of jurists like Hugo Grotius. And this is why in 1916, Joseph Kohler recommended that teachers of the law of nations refer to the Spanish natural law thinkers of the 16th and 17th centuries instead of Grotius. Tanaka followed suit, at least in adopting a critical view of Grotius. Tanaka emphasized a radical break between Grotius and the Enlightenment tradition of the natural law on the one hand and Aquinas' orthodox view of the natural law on the other. And he drew from Kohler to point out that the usual criticism of the natural law as non-responsive to social particularities and historical change, well, that should be directed at Grotius and the Enlightenment understanding of the natural law, not at Aquinas, who recognized flexibility in applying the natural law to the concrete acts of particular men. Note, Aquinas didn't go as far as Rudolf Stammler, who came up with the notion of the natural law with variable content. It's more, and for Aquinas, the question of applying the natural law to content is not variable. Now let us review the major sources of Benedict's thinking on the natural law, keeping these points in mind as interpretive guides. We must start with Benedict's 1964 untranslated German article, which I translate as The Natural Law, Gospel, and Ideology in Catholic Social Teaching. Natural Law, Gospel, and Ideology in Catholic Social Teaching, 1964. It does seem as though Benedict takes a critical stance against the natural law in this article. But on careful reading, one finds that he only criticizes rationales that only seem to be from the natural law or theology, but which have actually come from a historical social structure that feels natural. He even went so far as to refer to these formulas as the pseudonym of the natural law. In 2016, Benedict reflected on his contempt for the 19th century and his desire to get away from classical Thomism, and Speaker sees that confession as an explanation for why Benedict was hostile to the natural law in that 1964 article. There is more than an element of truth to that interpretation, as it is supported by Benedict's role as co-founder of the Communio Group only 8 years later and their well-known penchant for a ressourcement that was not unrelated to their sense of distance from certain kinds of mid-century neo-Thomism. But there may be another explanation for what Benedict is saying in that 1964 article, or at least a deeper element in Benedict's point about the pseudonym of natural law. Note that Benedict criticizes not the natural law per se, but what he calls a pseudonym of the natural law. The implication of a pseudonym is the misuse of or corruption of something that is not itself necessarily bad. That is, Benedict leaves unaddressed what the true name of the natural law is, in contrast to this pseudonym of the natural law that he criticizes. What Benedict is really critical of is the same thing Tanaka and Joseph Kohler, both strong defenders of the natural law, had attacked as the Enlightenment concept of the natural law. That's really what he's upset with. Benedict wrote in his 1964 article that the process of reason in history, as Windelband once defined the Enlightenment, has been claiming legitimacy for itself in matters of faith, and the continual spread of this type of thinking of natural law unfortunately resulted in a strengthening of the purely deductive process from its initial tentative beginnings. The result was a strange kind of positivism. So the distinction between these two understandings of the natural law, I think, can be also clarified by turning to Heinrich Roman, another scholar steeped in the Germanic tradition of jurisprudence, and I'm happy to say somebody who taught here at Georgetown many, many years ago and taught Father Shaw, of close memory to many of us. Roman describes these two types of natural law in the following terms. One is the idea of a revolutionary and individualistic natural law, essentially bound up with the basic doctrine of the state of nature, as well as with the concept of the state as a social unit which rests upon a free contract. It's arbitrary and artificial, determined by utility, and is not metaphysically necessary. The other is the idea of a natural law grounded in metaphysics that does not exist in a mythical state of nature before the laws, but lives and ought to live in them. In a similar manner, Tanaka rejected what he called the natural law of Enlightenment rationalism that considered subjective decisions by legislators, judges, or scholars as ipso facto rational and thus universal. He insisted that the idea, the norm, the goal of law must be sought in an order above law itself. That is, it must be sought in the world order that was designed by God's reason. So we may conclude that what Benedict had criticized as operating under the pseudonym of the natural law was not the natural law itself, but this kind of authoritarian, hyper-theorized, individualistic understanding of the natural law that Roman and Tanaka also criticized. This means that Speaker is also incorrect and asserting that Benedict did not embrace the natural law until his turn of the century criticism of liberation theology and the abortion rights campaign in Germany. For example, even in Benedict's 1992 speech in Bratislava, Slovakia, nobody really turns to the Bratislava speech much, I'm not sure why, but we're going to look at it. 1992, Benedict upholds the natural law in addressing the question of what constitutes a just state. He appealed to the Anglo-Saxon sphere, where democracy was at least partly conceived and realized on the basis of the tradition of natural law and of a fundamental Christian consensus that certainly had a very pragmatic character. Here we can see that Benedict associated democracy with a natural law and with a pragmatic character, precisely what he had found lacking in the post-Enlightenment pseudonym of the natural law. We see the same distinction between a good and a bad understanding of the natural law in Benedict's September 21st, 2000 debate with Paulo Flores de Arces. In response to Flores de Arces' rejection of the natural law, Ratzinger, Benedict, conceded that there was a certain excess in the use of the natural law in the church's social doctrine that arose in the late 19th century. And then in the 20th century, until Vatican II, there were excesses. But this fact that there was a little, let us say, exuberance, does not change the fact that it's still there in the writings of St. Paul. I would say that we can very well and must debate about the expansion of the natural law. How far does it extend? Benedict asks. Benedict set himself to that task of exploring how far the natural law extends in his 2003 masterpiece, my favorite work by Benedict, Truth and Tolerance, Christian Belief and World Religions, when he embraced the law as the condition of freedom and the absence of law as the absence of freedom. And then he asked the question, then how do we find the true law, the law that liberates, not the pseudo-law that oppresses? His answer was to find law in society, in community. He said, let us start with a small community we can view as a whole, so that a common shape of freedom arises from their coexistence. But no small community exists of itself. In seeking the true yardstick of freedom, the whole of mankind must be kept in view. And, as we see more and more clearly, again, not just today's mankind, but tomorrow's. In short, ubi societas, ibi ius. By the early 20th century, it becomes increasingly apparent that Benedict's understanding of the natural law is linked to his recognition that politics has a legitimate role to play, independent, if supportive, of the distinctive mission of the church. Natural law, already evident in Truth and Tolerance, is a key part of a human effort to establish justice in ways not reducible to religious faith or divine revelation. We find this in Reason and Faith for a Common Ethics, Benedict's 2004 dialogue with Jürgen Habermas, where Benedict criticizes a particular approach to the natural law, one that presupposes a concept of nature in which nature and reason mesh and nature itself is rational, as undermined, as we heard earlier, by the force of evolutionary theory. That view of natural law is undermined by the force of evolutionary theory. This argument, you note, is closely related to what Benedict had said about the natural law in his 1964 German article. But now Benedict explicitly offers a legitimate view of the natural law, one that goes back to the pagan jurist, Ulpian. Everybody remembers his dates, right? 172-23 AD. Okay. Not a Christian. Ulpian, who held that jus naturae est quod natura omnia animalia docet, the law of nature is what nature teaches all sentient beings. Ulpian's formula is a start, but ultimately insufficient for Benedict, who notes that we need to get at not merely what is true for all animalia, but what concerns specifically human duties that man's reason has created and for which there could be no response without reason. To supplement Ulpian's understanding of the natural law, Benedict turns to the concept of natural law found at the beginning of the 12th century Decretium Gratiani, where we find that the human race is governed by two things, namely natural law and custom. The natural law is the one contained in the law and the gospel, whereby everyone is commanded to do unto others what he wishes to be done to himself and is forbidden to inflict on others that which he does not wish to be done to himself. Putting together these two statements, we conclude that Benedict holds that the natural law is broader than the revealed truths of the Catholic Church, but is also inherent in church doctrine and has been a part of church teaching for centuries. This differentiated understanding of the natural law is evident in Benedict's 2005 encyclical Deus Caritas Est. A cursory reading of this encyclical might lead one to conclude that Benedict's focus on the natural law is about the division of duties between church and state. Well, that is indeed an element of his argument. But we must not overlook the critical role of society in Benedict's analysis of the conditions of justice. Note that Benedict writes that the just ordering of society and the state is a central responsibility of politics. For her part, the church, as the social expression of Christian faith, has a proper independence and is structured on the basis of her faith as a community, which the state must recognize. The two spheres are distinct, yet always interrelated. Here Benedict comes close to an explicit endorsement of Tanaka's argument that the church is a society and hence has its own laws. But his main point is that a just ordering of the state alone is not the end of politics, even as the establishment of a just society, which is the end of politics, is not the immediate responsibility of the church. Justice, Benedict teaches, is both the aim and the intrinsic criterion of all politics, and the church's specific role in this is simply to help purify reason and to contribute here and now to the acknowledgement and attainment of what is just. And the church does this on the basis of reason and natural law, namely, on the basis of what is in accord with the nature of every human being. It recognizes that it is not the church's responsibility to make this teaching prevail in political life. Rather, the church wishes to help form consciences in political life and to stimulate greater insight into the authentic requirements of justice, as well as greater readiness to act accordingly. That's Benedict's language. We can draw two key points from Benedict's writings on the natural law in Deus Caritas Est. One, society is the ground for the flourishing of justice, not the state. And two, the church has an important role to play as one of the members of society in the rational, non-coercive formation and propagation of justice. Such a claim is unimaginable without accepting the main principles of the sociological science of law as expounded by the early 20th century Freiheit movement. Informed by this tradition of prioritizing society over the state, Benedict addressed the distinctive roles of the state, society, and religion in his 1992 address in Bratislava, where he said, "The state establishes a relative ordering for life and society, but it cannot answer on its own the question of the meaning of human existence. Not only must it leave space open for something else, perhaps for something higher, it must also receive from outside itself the truth about what is right, since it does not bear this truth in itself." Now here Benedict was basically drawing from the Thomistic insight that government arises from society to which it is accountable. He also reminded his audience of how high the stakes were. National socialism, Marxism, were two 20th century examples of what happened when this important distinction between state and society was blurred or erased. Now here I will skip for a moment the next chronological piece, Benedict's 2009 encyclical Caritas in Veritate, not merely because I've already discussed it a little bit, but mainly because I want to conclude with it. So the next one I want to take up, the two remaining sources of Benedict's thought on the natural law, are his 2010 speech at Westminster Hall and his 2011 speech to the Bundestag. Both short speeches converge in an emphasis on the natural law as universally valid across cultural and religious divisions. At Westminster, Benedict reminded the British people that their abolition of the slave trade was, quote, built upon firm ethical principles rooted in the natural law. And he openly worried about where such firm ethical principles would be found today, as Christianity and its values were increasingly marginalized in affluent Western societies. But he was clear that he was not calling for a theocratic response to secularization. He was calling for a renewed appreciation of how the Catholic tradition maintains that the objective norms governing right action are accessible to reason, prescinding from the content of revelation. According to this understanding, the role of religion in public debate is not so much to supply these norms as if they could not be known to non-believers, still less to propose concrete political solutions which would lie altogether outside the competence of religion, but rather to help purify and shed light upon the application of reason to the discovery of objective moral principles. It's Benedict's language. I think the most important aspect of Benedict's Westminster speech was captured by Marta Cartabia and Andrea Simoncini, who argue that in it, quote, Benedict XVI overturns the assumption that the contribution of Christianity to the public debates derives from the command of an authority, ipse dicit. In political and legal disputes, he does not rely on the statements of the religious authority, but on the authority of reason. Now, in his speech to the Bundestag the following year, Benedict emphasizes the autonomy of reason, pointing out that, unlike other great religions, Christianity has never proposed a revealed law to the state and to society. That is to say, a juridical order derived from revelation. Instead, It is pointed to nature and reason as the true sources of law, and aligned itself with a philosophical and juridical movement that began to take shape in the 2nd century BC, the social natural law. Benedict maintains that this social natural law provided the basis for law up to the time of the Enlightenment and again after World War II. But he also recognizes that the idea of natural law is today viewed as a specifically Catholic doctrine, not worth bringing into discussion in a non-Catholic environment. In explaining how we have arrived at a situation where what was originally a pagan idea now seems too Catholic to be acceptable to non-Catholics, Benedict points to the broad popularity, especially in European society, of Hans Kelsen's positivist concept of nature as purely functional, an aggregate of objective data linked together in terms of cause and effect, with no ethical implications, this nature. Benedict did not surrender his embrace of the natural law. In his New Year's Day message of 2013, just weeks before he resigned, he said that, quote, "The precondition for peace is the dismantling of the dictatorship of relativism and of the supposition of a completely autonomous morality which precludes acknowledgement of the ineluctable natural moral law inscribed by God upon the conscience of every man and woman." These carefully crafted words accurately express Benedict's understanding of the natural law. In his earliest article on the natural law, he had criticized the tendency of some Catholic theologians to equate the natural law with revelation, undervaluing the role and power of human reason in its own right. But he was also critical of the secularist tendency to think that reason could be completely unmoored from the hand of God, both in its creation and in its substance, and then to regulate the natural law to a kind of fideism with Catholic coloring. Benedict's middle ground may be described as the analogical autonomy of reason. His understanding of the natural law followed from this understanding of human reason. The proper understanding of the natural law in practice should not be to associate it with a state, even a peaceful democratic state. Rather, drawing on the rich Germanic tradition of locating law in society, rather than as a function of sovereign command, Benedict reminded us that the natural law is found in the conscience of every man and woman. Much of the controversy over Caritas in Veritate that arose over fears that Benedict was calling for a world government or a world state was due to a failure to understand Benedict's position that law had its foundations in society, in the interrelationship of rational people, not in the commands of the sovereign. Without rejecting the legitimacy of the national state, and without succumbing to a positivism that put no limits on the rights of the national state, Benedict reminded us that law and justice ultimately require a true world authority, an authority that he located in the natural law. It was a prescient and courageous stance that reflected the fact that globalization is continuing apace and that there is consequently a greater need for a theory of law and justice commensurate with the demands of an increasingly globalized society, not a globalized state. A globalized society. Ubi societas.
Now we have a reply from Father Joseph Katursky of the Society of Jesus.
Thank you, Father Fields, for this invitation. The other organizers, I'm grateful. And my thanks to Professor Kevin Doak for giving us such a detailed account of the thought of Pope Benedict on natural law theory, as well as his account of some of the relevant secondary literature. Now, in my experience of conferences, I'm very mindful that the job of a response is not to give a separate paper, much as I am tempted to. For while I agreed with much that was said, I disagree with a number of things that were said, but the point is not a separate paper. And so instead, I like to confine myself just to raising a few questions. And I was very happy in Father Field's reference to the architecture of this room, to notice that I can take as my icon this wonderful little gargoyle who's standing there underneath a column, and he looks like he's about to be crushed by the column.
Perhaps that's what a philosopher will experience among theologians. But I will simply take heart from the gargoyle who's not crushed yet, and I would like to ask three questions. One of them pertains to the general question with regard to understanding Benedict's consistency. And I'm going to certainly agree, and I take this to be Professor Doak's main point, that Benedict has a great consistency over the years. That is, I think he's shown very convincingly that those who argue for inconsistency are wrong. But my question is Benedict a Thomist? Now, I'm a Thomist. I love Thomism, left, right, and center. I'm really heart and soul. I also love Benedict very much. But I don't think Benedict's a Thomist. And so I think what the inconsistency that's in the secondary literature is pointing out that he's not always taking the Thomist version of this, because there are other versions of natural law which are also deeply fundamentally important to the Christian tradition. So that's going to be one question. A second question that I want to put to this is the understanding of the role of the social character of the natural law and the question of the interpretation of the phrase, the sociological school of natural law, sociological approach to law, and the interpretation of that phrase, ubi societas ibi ius. And my concern there is not that the natural law doesn't have a social dimension, but I get worried about that sociological interpretation and sociological school, because I think that what they're looking at is the law that societies generate. And so you'd have to be working backwards, not forwards. It's not that the laws that they generate are natural law. Some of them succeed in reflecting natural law, but others do not. And so I found that to be very uncritically handled. Third, the question about Vince Strand's interpretation of Caritas in Veritate. Because in my judgment, the one document in the entire corpus of Benedictine writings that is inconsistent is Caritas in Veritate, and I'd like to suggest a reason for that inconsistency. So that's the general game plan here. First, it seems to me that Professor Doak is right to say that figures like Manfred Spiker are incorrect in holding that Benedict did not embrace the natural law until his turn-of-the-century criticism of liberation theology and the abortion rights campaign in Germany. Doak's analysis of the 1964 article by Ratzinger is clearly an attack on the early modern and Enlightenment concepts of the natural law, championed by the likes of Locke and Rousseau. They really are natural rights thinkers who've turned the whole thing over, and they simply keep the name natural law because of its enormous prestige. But it's also a little critical of the Thomistic approach to it. And I don't think that that can be overlooked. Spiker is correct about that, I think, that there's a criticism of the Thomism, because I think what you've got in Ratzinger is a basic Augustinian. And Augustine also has a natural law theory. Someday, when I have the chance, an article I intend to write is going to be Augustine on Noah and the natural law. And when you look through the Dei Civitate Dei in any number of places, this is one of the main places where he's recurrently treated, where he's thinking about how natural law works. But let me expand the point for a minute that there's versions of natural law which are genuinely parts of the tradition and are not Thomistic. I'd like to refer you in particular to the book that I consider the best book on this subject. It's entitled First Grace by Russ Hittinger. And even that title, in a way, is interesting, given the concerns we have with nature and grace. And that's one of the places where I disagree with, I think, with Father Fields and with some of the others, in that I myself think that Henry de Lubach and others have thoroughly mushed the whole problem, and that they need a much stronger distinction between nature and grace, that in fact they make impossible much of what is Catholic theology if they continue to meld them together in that dialectical way.
But my point about Russ Hittinger's book is that he names it First Grace because he follows the procedure that you need to learn by making distinctions. And so that there's a way in which all nature is graced. Yes, it is a gift of God. But that's a different kind of grace than what we mean by the grace that comes with Christ, than what we mean by supernatural grace, than what we mean by actual grace. That is, you need to distinguish among the types of grace. And that when one does so, it's perfectly fine to do as Hittinger does, to call natural law the first grace. That is, because of the way we're built with our nature, there has been something given by God that is directive. In particular, what Hittinger points out, and this will be helpful for the rest of asking those three questions, and I'll get to them back to them in a minute. Hittinger insists that there are three essential foci for any genuine natural law theory, rather as to differentiate it from its various counterfeits and surrogates that try to claim the name that are not worthy of it. There is an anthropological dimension, an epistemological dimension, and a theological dimension. Let me go through those three briefly and then get back to my questions. If a theory claiming to be natural law does not provide an adequate account of human nature as the place where the ground of natural law precepts can be discovered, it will turn out to be some other form of ethics other than natural law, for it will be taking something else as the ground of the natural law. That is, what natural law theory in any of its versions say is you find it in human nature. Perhaps it will be the ground that is found in some divine voluntarism. We know that from biblical ethics. But precisely in the case of Ratzinger, I think that what it is it's the notion that, and the one that Augustine so champions, is that God has designed this nature, and he has oriented us to something that has certain telic operations. This is why I would say, yes, Ratzinger has natural law theory, but it's not particularly of the Thomist variety. It's one that is much more deeply Augustinian in its orientation. But, of course, there are other versions which are counterfeit versions. Some find it in the form of state ideology. Some find it in the form of human rational construction rather than in what is traditional natural law, namely this focus on human nature. When you get to an appropriate Augustinian version of it, there is a social character to it because we can't live alone. We live in various forms of society, beginning with the family. Second, if a theory is claiming to be a natural law theory, does not provide an adequate account of human reason as able to discover the ground of natural law in human nature, it will be some other form of ethics than natural law, for it will be taking something else as the ground of our knowledge of morality. It will perhaps be locating it in the form of some kind of religious faith, where we depend upon divine revelation for our knowledge, or in some sociological relationship in which we take what our culture teaches us to be legitimate and valid. I suspect that that's at the heart of much of the sociological interpretation, at least that part of it. I've not read Tanaka, but in the part of it that I have read, and I'm extremely suspicious of it. One finds it sometimes in the Kantian reliance on practical reason to generate moral norms. Some of Professor Doak's formulations made me nervous because it sounded like it was practical reason generating it rather than speculative reason discovering it. Speculative reason does have to discover the need for certain social relationships, but it doesn't find it by looking at the laws that are actually generated. It finds it by looking at the needs of human nature, and that's what Rahman's book is largely about. I mean, it's a magnificent treatise on the subject. Finally, if a theory claiming to be natural law does not provide an adequate account of God as the source of the natural law within human nature, that is, the source of obligation for natural law precepts, it will be some other form of ethics other than natural law, for it will be something taking something else as the ground of moral obligation. Perhaps social pressures to conform in certain ways that are exerted by human law or by human custom. Again, my fear about the sociological interpretation, or by the demands of rational self-interest, or by the Kantian understanding of the autonomy of reason for the legislation of morality. For the sake of time, I'll omit a section that I have here on the way Locke does it, on the way Kant does it, and consider instead the second major question that I want to raise. Namely, it's very good to see Professor Doak bringing out the social character of human nature and the consequences of the social dimension of the natural law. But I have my trouble with the phrase that he made so crucial to his argument. Namely, when he takes that particular phrase, ubi societas ibi ius, and tries to argue that it should be taken as where there is society, there will be law. Okay, I think there's a way in which that's true. But I'm, again, very fearful because societies generate very different kinds of law. And I suspect that what we should take it as is where there is society, there is an expectation of some kind of justice. That's a deeply Augustinian argument. You remember that part in the De Civitate Dei when Augustine is talking about even in a band of robbers, there's still going to be justice within the band of robbers, or the band of robbers isn't going to continue to exist as a band for very long. That is, they're just toward themselves. And it's not that that's the essence of justice. It's simply that where there is any form of society, even if it's badly organized, there has to be justice or the thing will break up, but there will be justice to different degrees. As such, when it's taken in that respect, one finds that is what is so deeply Benedictine about it. And here I refer to what I think is the clearest text that exists. I agree with the Truth and Tolerance, excellent book. But the clearest text, I think, is that portion of Deus Caritas Est, where Benedict is distinguishing between what he wants a church to do and what it is that he expects that any form of state will do. Namely, the state will have to try to find systems of justice, that is, ways in which to administer the law that will actually bring about some justice, or the state will collapse. That is, there will be too much internal tension because it isn't providing for the justice that is needed. I think that there is a way in which I'm agreeing with Professor Doak about it. I don't mean to be simply quibbling with translation, but that it's not enough to take it as mere law because societies can generate any number of forms of law. Finally, the third point that I'd like to bring up, I'll let Ben Strand defend himself, but it seems to me that both Strand is wrong and Professor Doak is wrong, at least to this extent, in that I do not think that you find such a tremendous basic continuity and consistency between everything else that Benedict Ratzinger wrote and what's in Deus and what's in Civitas in Caritate. And here I would propose as the reason, or at least as evidence of the reason, Civitas in Caritate was intended, I believe, to form a further corrective to Paul VI's Populorum Progressio. Populorum Progressio, written in 1967, had proposed a vision of human development that leaves most, or leaves many people like myself, fearful. I think it's a vision of human development in which there's the grounds for something that's correct, but is taken far too economically. In 1987, John Paul II produced the Sollicitudere Socialis as the first important corrective, taking us back to, in a Thomistic natural law theory, the notion of the human person and what is needed for personal development. Caritas in Veritate was expected to come in 2007. And to be an updated corrective of that. In the very process in which the Benedictine encyclicals are always created and then revised and revised and revised, an extremely detailed process involving all sorts of Vatican congregations, but especially the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. It came out in 2009 as a committee document. I think Benedict threw up his hands, and there are purple passages in which you can find Benedict's opinion, but you also find a variety of prudential applications that raise, for me, far more serious problems than are even present in the original 1967 document, Populorum Progressio. I must admit, I think it's a part where we're over, where we're beyond, we're now after the classical period of Catholic social teaching, and we now have an entrenched bureaucracy which has subverted an encyclical. So my own version on that is that this is not an adequate place to get true Benedictine doctrine. Let me say one word in its defense and then finish. I think that the one thing that Caritas in Veritate should be kept for, there's only one that I know of, is that I think it finally begins the attack on the siloing of Catholic social teaching issues. That is, for the sake of clarity, the popes over a century had written their various encyclicals on only economic issues or only political issues or only family issues, even when they put one next to the other, as Pius XI did, for instance, with Casti Canubi and with Quadragesimo Anno. But they inadvertently produced this silo problem of making you think that you can handle only economic issues to the exclusion and without reference to the others. That, I think, is Benedict's contribution to Caritas in Veritate, where he insists on seeing the relation between one and the other. For the rest, I doubt that you can get an adequate picture, and where you get it in those purple passages, it seems to me that it's far more Augustinian than Thomistic. So I ask those as three questions. Perhaps that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Father Katursky. Thank you, Professor Doak, and thank you for generating some tension in your interpretations. And what I'd like to do is now throw this open to questions.
Father Katursky, I think I wanted to push back a little bit on one of the things you said when you were arguing against the Benedictine doctrine. You said that the sociological view of that is accurately, whether it be accurately described as natural law or not, for those three reasons you listed. While I'm with you, I certainly don't agree with that as I certainly don't think that's right. Or an accurate description of reality, but I think we can accurately call it natural law. And the reasons that you listed that we can't seem to equally apply to new natural law, for example.
I don't think new natural law is natural law at all.
Well, here we go. And again, I don't like new natural law. I'm not a new natural lawyer.
I think it's an interesting theory, but it's not natural law.
Well,
they're recent. They're starting to call it basic goods theory, which I think is a better name.
Mm-hmm. But it is grounded in human nature.
It is not. It's grounded in reason.
Well, it's grounded in practical reason.
Which is not sufficiently speculative.
Well, I agree with you. It's still reason, right? So can it accurately be typified as a natural law theory, albeit not the right one?
No, in my judgment, because that is to say grounded in speculative reason means we're looking at something and discovering something there. And in my judgment, the new natural law tradition tends instead to say, let's look at what we think will be reasonable and lay out these grounds of reasonableness. So it's grounded really in practical reason and not in speculative reason about human nature. Now, when you get individual fear, we had John Finnis come to Fordham once for a two-day visit, and in the private visit, sort of the second day, sitting around over coffee all day long, he was making all the concessions we'd want to make. If he would make them in print, I'd be happy to admit then he's part of the natural law fold. But in unwilling to make them in print because he's dealing politically with lawyers, politicians, statesmen who are unwilling to do that work of the speculative reason, looking at the intrinsic teleology of natural orientation of the goods in a human persons. And if you won't argue that way in public, then you're not a natural law thinker.
So why is speculative reason necessary?
Because what you're looking at is human nature and you're finding something there, you're not imposing it on it. Whereas with practical reason, what we're doing is devising a law, devising a maxim, devising a principle, and which grounded in our reason of what we think will be reasonable. This is why, for instance, in the formalist version of the Golden Rule, it's not natural law, right? So if I say, do unto others as you have them do unto you. Now, if you were assuming speculative reason and saying, ah, there are things that are good for a human person, and therefore I must be sure to do them, or bad for a person, I must be sure to avoid them, great, that's natural law, because I'm looking at the human person for the ground. But if I'm a sophomore with a sophomore's relativistic mentality, do unto others whatever you'd have, whatever we want them to do unto you, or don't do, well, I'd be willing to accept that. I'd be willing to try to get away with the law. I mean, that is, if it's purely formalistic, then it's practical reason imposing a law, not discovering one. I know I'm overdoing it a little bit, but it's to my desire to overdo it is to point out you can do the practical reason, but if it's a two-step dance, the leader in the dance has to be speculative reason, receiving before imposing.
Father Petersky, could you describe a little more what the Augustinian
natural law might look like in the context of how you believe benefit Caesar? Sure. I think the Augustinian natural law version is deeply rooted in the notion that there's human sinfulness and that you can find human sinfulness empirically. So it seems to me that in those three criterion that I mentioned, the anthropological, the epistemological, and the anthropological is you don't have pure nature. What you have is wounded nature. We have no access to pure nature. Our reason is a wounded reason. And so that we're going to be able to figure certain things out, but there are going to be certain things beyond our competence. So that in a Augustinian version, much heavier emphasis is put upon the theological pull in those three. God has to help show us what it is that we need to correct the defects in our nature and the defects in our reasoning. So he will show. There will be an awful lot of light that will shine. Now, I find that to be just typically Benedictine. In fact, if you look not only at the three encyclicals or about the wonderful other corpus library he brings with us, but how about looking at the fourth encyclical that actually was the first one published by Francis, Lumen Fidei? I mean, Francis himself admits that 95% of that was written by Benedict. And what is it? It's the notion the light of faith is needed, not necessarily a light that will show you everything, but a light that will show you just enough of the steps ahead to proceed. It seems to me that that's the Augustinian version of the natural law. And so that when you get to documents like De Civitate Dei, the part, for instance, to which I alluded before about Noah, there you've got as close as you can come to with unwounded nature. That is, even though he's a descendant of Adam, he's, for Augustine, a recreation. That is, God is starting this again. And yet, God, interestingly, Augustine points out, changes the nature of the covenant. So that with Adam, which is as close as you can get to pure, unwounded nature, there will be an immediate reward for punishment and an immediate immediate reward for virtue and immediate punishment for vice. With Noah, the covenant changes. Namely, God will allow the good and the bad to prosper, and he will sort it out later. So that with Noah, there's still an expectation, we'll do as much as we can in getting it right, we'll use our reason as hard as we can use it to get it right, but we need an awful lot of divine light to see much further ahead, given our woundedness and given the woundedness of our reason.
I think it might be a good idea if would you like to respond to Father Katursky?
I should say something.
Yeah, please.
I just simply want to thank Father Katursky for what's been really a wonderful, I mean, this is what papers and commentators should be, I think. There's a kind of engagement here. He's really helped me rethink some things, and I hope that this will be stronger when I finish. Now, there's places where we agree. There's places where we will inevitably disagree. One of the places I agree is I don't want to label anybody a Thomist. I don't want to call Benedict, I don't know what that means. I don't want to call him a Marxist. I don't want to call him, maybe I'll call him a Catholic. But beyond that, I'm not sure what he means. Now, what I did try to say is where I found elements that I thought were Thomistic in his thinking, I want to identify those elements, but I don't know if that makes him necessarily a Thomist. I think Father Katursky's concerns about the sociological school, the Freirecht, are well-placed. My job was not here to provide a kind of overall theological definition of the school, but to show how Catholics and others could go into that school and how the unintentional, perhaps, consequences of it were to lead to a renaissance of natural law thinking in Germany in the early 20th century, right at the time when many of the people who would then later teach Benedict would have been influenced by those kinds of thinking. So I'm trying to situate this historically without essentializing it.
Essentializing, by the way, is one of the big problems, I think, when theologians often talk about the natural law. And what I'm trying to do here, working through Tanaka, who was a jurist, who did believe, much more like Dominic, that practical reason has a role in the natural law, was to say, you know, the natural law precedes Christianity. You know, Ulpian comes in here, we can take it back to the ancient Greeks. So unless you're going to say that all the natural law prior to St. Augustine was not natural law, which would be rather difficult to sustain historically, I think we have to look for the foundations of natural law in something other than revelation, something other than the notion of sin as Christians would understand it, and something that is universal to all humans, whether they're Christian or not. And that's why I titled this Globalism. And that's why Tanaka, who had to deal with Japanese who were mostly non-Christian, nonetheless said, there is hope here because we're all human and we can reason together. And it's very interesting because, I don't know, Father Katursky may respond that this is practical reason, but Tanaka's notion was the natural law began out in the steppes of Asia when two tribes traded. Mm-hmm. And he says, what do I mean by that? Because Tanaka's expertise was actually business law, corporate law. And most people who approach the natural law approach it from public law, criminal law. You know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery. Tanaka said, no, let's step aside from that because, by the way, public law or criminal law is the one that's most particular to cultural formation. Societies have a wide range of differences when it comes to criminal law and what constitutes law and how it should be punished than they do when it comes to things like business law. Contracts must be upheld. So he says, take us to the steppes of Central Asia. Two tribes that don't even speak the same language, don't have any values the same, don't have the same religion, meet to trade. You know, felts for wampum or something, beads. Now, how does the one side, when they get the beads, know that they can't just run and go, keep their beads and their felts? How does the other side know when they hand over the goods that they're going to get something in return? And this is what Tanaka calls the intuitive foundations of natural law. Not so much ethics or pragmatics, but a simple notion that human beings are rational. And by rational, it means they can take my goods and run. Nobody will trade with them again. The word will get out. That's just reason. That's human beings reasoning with one another. From that foundation, he concludes that laws which are codified in all kinds of religious and cultural and legal structures have something underlying them that can take us to what he wanted to call world law. His whole impetus was to talk about whether or not there could be something called world law that had force over all people. He's not talking theology now. Okay? Just talking about, is there something that all human beings can share in terms of a desire for order? This takes us back to the question of justice. Now, some people say order without justice is not an order worth having. Most lawyers, and Tanaka included, would say order itself is a modicum of justice. There are better orders, more just orders, less just orders, but if you take order away, and this is what I think even Benedict was saying by the law that makes us free, law by its nature frees us from anarchy. Law by its nature frees us to be able to achieve certain things. That's not a theological assertion. Of course we know that after natural law, we need to have redemption. We need both the natural law and the eternal law, right? We know that for our salvation. But the first grounding here is the natural law is not the means of salvation, but it's a start. It's a start because it recognizes that all human beings have the ability to reason. Speculative, pragmatic, phronesis, which I'm not sure is something that we shouldn't accept. But the very fact that we can reason is the grounds for understanding faith. And I frankly feel, after reading Benedict, that he puts the emphasis on reason. I gave you some quotes where he says, you know, it's not the church's business to create social justice. And that shocks a lot of people. But Francis essentially said that. It's the church's job to shape consciences so that people will go out and use those consciences through reason to create social justice. And that's where I think natural law has a role to play. It's not the key to your salvation, but it's not something you should dismiss lightly. And for those of us who deal with non-Christian people all the time, it's extremely important. And that's why I also wanted to bring in this element of globalism, which is there in Caritas in Veritate, and it bothers a lot of people, and it shouldn't bother them, because it's not about creating a world state. It's about recognizing, first of all, that the church is a global society. And if the church is a global society, that means there has to be a global authority. And therefore, from that perspective, I think we can engage with the natural law as a kind of perhaps secular cousin of the church's global moral authority.